Today, inside property bubbles. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Notice Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a little philosophy on the side. I'm joined today by Ben, who's been deep into property bubbles. Hi, Ben.
How you going, Martin?
Yeah, pretty good. Thanks for your time today. Great to have you on board for a chat. And you've been doing some quite detailed research on the nature of property bubbles and specifically in Australia.
Yeah, so I've written a book which I named As Unsafe As Housing, at Houses, in which I go into elaborate the structural imbalances of Australia's property market and why I think that it's unstable. And then I've developed a thesis on housing bubbles and the criteria to kind of meet them and the influencing associated factors with housing bubbles.
Okay, well, let's go into that in a bit more detail. But before we go, let me just sort of ask with a basic question. Do you think our property prices in Australia are overinflated? In other words, we are in a bubble. They are over normal value.
Absolutely, I do. Now, essentially, to have a housing bubble, you need three major components. Now, the first component, I'll start off with defining a housing bubble. A housing bubble in its sense is just a dissociation from what's considered normal intrinsic values and fundamentals. So to have a housing bubble, as I said before, you need three major components, but there's also additional influencing factors involved that help inflate the bubble. Now, the first one is loose credit underwriting standards. And in essence, banks make their money by issuing debt. However, there's a trade-off between the amount of credit that is issued in competition for market share and the probability of bad debt being placed on the bank's balance sheet. Now, if you look, the easiest way to find imprudent lending is to look for a runaway in private debt. However, there's other ways that we can see that, and that's essentially looking at excessive Ponzi financing models, such as interest-only loans and loans against equity. Now, we know during the boom that we saw a lot of interest-only loans, which equated to around 42% of all residential mortgage loans, and some banks were exceeding 55% during that time. And we also know that loans against equity were proliferantly used during the boom as a means to capitalize on capital appreciation. However, what that does is it exacerbates the risk both on the buyer's side and the lender's side. And that's because it's all well and good during periods of price appreciation. However, when the price inevitably falls, what happens is that it's more susceptible to skew the assets versus the liabilities, and therefore it can create problematic issues in the future based upon that. There's another indicators such as the residential mortgage loans as a percentage of total loans. In Australia, we've seen 60% of total issued loans have been to the residential sector. Now, that's the double the amount of the United States, and it's triple the amount of the United Kingdom. And what that tells me is that our lenders have a higher appetite for consumption and speculative purposes as opposed to investing in sustainability, such as small business, manufacturing, entrepreneurialism, innovation, things that help create a stable economy into the future and thus create increased wages and increasing jobs. And then another example would be what the Royal Commission found or elaborated on, which was abundantly known beforehand, is that the banks were using a benchmark known as the household expenditure measure. And what was happening is that they were misinterpreting household expenditures, and therefore people were getting loans that they probably shouldn't have received had their application been assessed more thoroughly. So that's the first main component of a housing bubble. And the second component is a ramification of the first component. And that in itself is excessive private debt and increasing unaffordability. Now, I look at these metrics both quantitatively and qualitatively, and the objective data amplifies that Australia has a severe private debt problem. Now, and you only need to look at the debt ratios to understand that. We have the second highest household debt to GDP ratio in the world. We're in the top four for household debt to disposable income, and we lead the world for a debt serviceability ratio. Now, the important point with household debt is that a lot of the household debt is consumed into mortgages, because mortgages are essentially one of the largest purchases people will make in their lifetimes. And if you look at the ABS occupancy figures, what we know is that 30% of people own their home outright, which is down by 40% 25 years ago. 33% of people rent, which is up by 27% during that same time. And therefore, 37% of people have a mortgage, which means that a lot of that household debt is concentrated to the 37%. And we know by empirical evidence that financial crises are often catalyzed by marginal borrowers' inability to pay their financial obligations, which is amplifies the risk that Australia currently has. Now, then again, there's the affordability side. And for that, I tend to look at more qualitative research, such as surveys. So, for example, the International Housing Affordability Survey, which ranks Sydney as 3, Melbourne as 4, and 10 other Australian cities in the top 50 of the world's most unaffordable markets. And in addition to that, there's other surveys, such as there was one done in 2018 by a company called Mozo. And what they found was that 35% of respondents said that were homeowners said they couldn't afford the property that they were living in if they were to pay today's prices. And the research is summated by saying that it illustrates we have a broken housing market. In addition to that, there's anecdotal evidence. For example, I've spoken to a lot of lenders, and what they're telling me is that there's an increasing trend of young people requiring help from their parents to get into the mortgage market. And there's your mortgage stress surveys, for example, which highlights the increasing stress in meeting financial obligations. And then there's other surveys as well, such as the Triple J What's Up in Your World survey, which has a higher demographic for young people and illustrates the fact that housing affordability is an increasing issue for these young people. And many of them think that they will never get into the property market. Now, the reason housing affordability is such an imperative topic is because, first of all, those that can afford to get into the market, whether that be through a parental gift or through a higher income, they're more prone to over leverage and therefore spend less on discretionary items. And as a result, that impedes the velocity of circulating money in the long term, and therefore jobs begin to suffer because one person's expenditure is another person's income. Now, the second reason is that people need to be able to afford property. And the reason being is that sooner or later, whether prices fall by this exogenous shock that we're seeing from the virus or not, there's going to be a transition from older Australians into retirement. And therefore, what we're likely to see is a increase in volumes in the property market due to the liquidity that's needed to fund the lifestyles of the older generation. And simply speaking, if people can't afford to buy the property at their asking prices due to a lack of wage growth, then ultimately it will lead to falling prices. Now, when you see falling prices from an overextended market, that creates a system where it's more prone to a negative feedback mechanism, and that in itself can lead to financial crises. So that's the second component. The third and final component is what I find to be quite understated, and that is regards to behavioral finance, in specifically cognitive bias and irrational exuberance. Now, we know that markets are driven by human nature, and housing bubbles are often driven by a social anxiety known as the fear of missing out. And the fear of missing out is essentially just an extrapolation of past trends to future trends, bringing forward future demand to the present. And that is driven by a multitude of aspects, but in particular, confirmation bias, cognitive dissonance, the ostrich effect, which are all in itself ways to ignore conflicting data in favor of information that best suits the desired narrative. Now, that can be done both advertently or inadvertently, such as advertently through someone's sifting through information and only choosing relevant information that suits what they want to do, or it can be inadvertently through the information that's provided through the media that could sometimes be subject to vested interests and therefore elaborates a narrative that suits the position of the author and not so much the buyer, and therefore as a result risk is understated, and which leads to poor decision making. So they're the three main components of a housing bubble, but then again there's factors that help inflate the housing bubble, and that is things like fiscal policy, such as negative gearing, capital gains tax exemptions, first home owner grants, which incentivizes people to buy property, which creates further demand and puts a buoyancy to price appreciation. And then there's other things such as monetary policy easing, which sometimes works in amalgamation with macroprudential easing, like we saw last year. And that in itself creates more borrowing capacity for borrowers, and as a result, they can bid more on housing, and therefore the price appreciates. And there's other things as well, such as population growth, which generally before the virus accounts for about 1.6% of current population and attributes 0.4% to aggregate GDP, which stimulates demand for services, in particular housing. However, I do argue that we're meeting the dwelling constructions adequately meeting the change in population growth. So I don't think that's a influencing factor during the past 4 years. And then finally, there's a what I call an observational factor in the boom, but an influencing factor during the bust, and that is the crowding effect of employment. Now, simply speaking, resources follow the money. Wherever the money is, the resources will follow. And during housing bubbles, what happens is you see a lot of activity in the real estate sector, and as a result, more people are employed in that sector. However, when prices inevitably fall, what you see is a rising in unemployment because the demand has diminished, but the resources are still there. And that can lead to a negative feedback mechanism where unemployment rises, and that creates a cascading effect of the velocity of circulating money into the future. So in essence, that is my thesis on housing bubbles and how it relates to Australia. However, I do go into more depth in my book, but to keep it short, that's the summary of how I believe Australia is in a housing bubble currently.
Okay, man. Well, that's very interesting. And you've certainly, I think, covered, one, a lot of ground, but two, you've hit the nail on the head in terms of all the various factors. But I want to ask you this question. Who do you think is ultimately accountable for creating the bubble then?
The accountability needs to go on the Reserve Bank of Australia. I believe that they've cut interest rates far too low and they've been held there for far too long. Now, I recognise there's issues associated with that regarding the currency and also with what's going around the globe, in the Western world in particular. However, I feel that it's created the housing bubble, which will subsequently lead to an inevitable bust. And the other people that are associated with inflating this housing bubble is, of course, policymakers that enticed incentives such as negative gearing and capital gains tax exemptions and things that lead to rising housing appreciation to temporarily mask systemic imbalances in the economy. So they're the main two factors. But then there's an obvious conformity bias that's occurred. So the policy makers can't be solely responsible for this. There is a conformity bias where people watch housing appreciate and they think, well, housing went up X amount in the last 5 years. It's going to go X amount in the next 5 years. So I need to buy now. And one person follows another person following another person. And that creates the demand until eventually it becomes exhausted and it implodes on itself.
I call that the lemming effect because, yeah. You know, that's exactly what I see in my surveys too. And I guess, you know, one of the counter arguments that is made as to why this bubble can perpetuate itself is that interest rates have never been lower. So if you look at the amount that people are paying on average on their mortgage now, it's roughly the same than it was 5 or 8 years ago. Do you think there's any validity in that argument, or do you think those other factors that you've mentioned basically mean that that is a too myopic view of what's going on?
Well, obviously, lower interest rates increases borrowing capacity, which has potential to increase housing prices. But you have to remember this. So first of all, housing markets are prone to extension beyond intrinsic value. But more specifically, an important factor is to understand that it's not necessarily the current rate of interest rates. It's what stimulates demand is the change in the interest rates. And what I mean by that is that when interest rates are cut, there's a lot of hype in association to the real estate market because people think, oh, my mortgage is going to get cheaper and therefore increasing demand into the market, and as a result more mortgages are issued and more people bid up on housing and therefore the price increases. So it's not necessarily the current rate. Like, current rate does apply to the purchasing power, but it's how, as I said previously, housing markets are human nature. They're driven by people's confidence, and the change in the interest rates on when the Reserve Bank becomes dovish on monetary policy creates a need to bring forward future purchases, which correlates to increasing prices. We're already at the Reserve Bank's currently at 0.25% right now. Interest rates, mortgage rates are around between 2% and 3%. You have to wonder how far scope do they have to consistently lower the interest rates. They could go another 0.25%, which is beyond what was recently considered as lower bound. And they probably will, in my opinion. Will they go negative interest rates? You don't know. Like, the RBA have essentially ruled it out. But you don't know what could happen. It depends as well on the economy and how our economy survives this virus in particular, and if there's global contagion from overseas, and it's multifactorial really. But realistically, we're running out of scope to keep that demand going.
And it's interesting because, of course, the Reserve Bank's model for housing, which they published just over a year ago, didn't really have much in it to do with credit at all. They basically argued that house prices could definitely accelerate as rates were cut and drew quite a clear connection between those two things, but really didn't think that the debt side of the equation was really that important.
Well, if you look at empirical evidence, like, this has all been done historically. That we are not the first country to have a housing bubble, nor will we be the last. Yet people believe this time is different. Like, loose lending practices have been played out throughout history. For example, the United States had loose lending practices, which attributed to their housing bubbles. Now, I know the GFC was attributed to derivatives and things like that as well, but predominantly it was caused by loose lending. And so we are not the first housing bubble to also see increasing intervention to prop up the market as well. For example, Ireland relied heavily on population growth and construction, which ultimately in the end proved that it didn't work. Japan tried exceeding the life of the mortgages, which also proved to be an inefficient way of propping up the housing market. So my philosophy is that this is not different to what's happened in the past, but yet people believe that it is. And inevitably, I don't know when exactly it will happen, but what will happen is that the demand will simply be exhausted. The intervention will be too extravagant, and then prices will begin to decline, and then it'll be increasingly difficult to change that velocity of the cascading effect through further intervention once it meets a certain threshold.
So do you think that property bubbles always burst, or do you think it's conceivable to manage a bubble down over time?
I don't think you can taper a housing bubble, and it's never been done historically. If we do that, we'll be the first economy in the history of capitalism to achieve that feat. I think it's unlikely, highly unlikely. It's possible, but it's very, very unlikely. And for the reason being that for our housing bubble to continue, we need to see rising prices because the yields are so small. And therefore, as soon as it becomes unattractive to invest, we're going to see rising listings. And as a result, we're going to see falling prices, which is associated with a negative wealth effect, which, as I said prior, impedes the velocity of circulating money and therefore leads to a slow economy and more unemployment and serious economic instability down the track.
Okay. And my last question, Ben, is this. Is it a bubble across the whole of Australia, or are there different bubbles in different locations? I'm thinking regional versus, you know, CBD. How have you thought about that?
The housing bubble is predominantly located on the eastern coast of Australia, in particular of the cities with higher population growth, such as Sydney and Melbourne. We saw in about 10 or 12 years ago, Perth was quite overvalued due to mining. However, when that dissipated, they saw decreasing values in their homes despite monetary policy easing. And then, of course, there's like the property market in general is quite granular. You have multiple different markets and some are more overvalued than others. However, also, what I need to elaborate on the fact is that when you see major housing markets go down, that can bring down even reasonably valued markets in rural towns, which I personally still believe the rural towns are overvalued based on the income in that area, particularly the ones that rely on tourism and things like that.
Well, that's certainly what I see in my mortgage stress data. It isn't just located in the main urban centres. It's pretty much a problem across the whole of the country, simply because, as you say, incomes are lower, So relatively speaking, you know, prices are still very high. Ben, I appreciate your time today. If people want to get hold of your book, how do they go about it?
I'll send you a link to it if you like, or you can just go on my Twitter page, which is Ben McAvoy AUS.
Great. Okay. Well, we'll put the link below. People, I'm sure, will be very interested. And I appreciate your time today. You've clearly done lots of work, and I think you've put your finger on some very, very important points. So I appreciate your sharing those with us today.
No worries. Happy to talk to you.
Great. Thanks, Ben. Okay. See you soon. Thank you.
See you, mate. Bye.